This episode is brought to you by LaFosse Academy, a program dedicated to helping people from diverse backgrounds break into the tech industry. They don't just train you with the skills you need, they help you to land your first role, give you real-world experience and a strong foundation to launch your career in tech. For businesses, the Academy offers a way to build diverse, future-ready teams while creating opportunities for talented individuals who might not have had a traditional route into tech. So, whether you're looking to start a career in tech or you're a business leader ready to build a stronger, more diverse team, speak to LaFosse Academy and take the next step. At Elevate Colour, we're proud to share their mission to level the playing field and create a tech workforce that truly reflects society. Hi everyone, welcome back to Race to the Top with me, Oki Elazi. My guest today is Dr. Stacey Moore, who's the founder of Inner Circles, a psychologist and public speaker. We had an incredible conversation about many things, specifically the fact that we never actually grow up, how she used to sing Black Brown Girl in the Ring when she was growing up as a kid, how becoming a doctor was a love letter to her grandparents, and how having braid locked hair really meant that she was being her authentic self in the workplace. The conversation was incredible and very enlightening, and I hope you think so too. So let's get into it. Welcome, Stacey.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's brilliant, brilliant. Great having you here. Great to have a chance to talk, other than all the stuff we normally talk about how we are going to change the world.
Yeah.
So, as I was reading about you, I talked about this whole thing about communities of practice or improving communities of practice. Just to help us, what's that mean?
What's it mean? Yeah. It is acknowledging that it's not going to take one person to make changes in this world. Most changes, if not all, that are going to be long-lasting, that are wide-ranging, they have to involve a community of people. You've got not only the people who these changes might affect, but people who are allies and appreciate that there's something that needs to be different. And it's things that move the world on.
Mm-hmm.
So the examples that I often talk about are things like maternal mental health or, you know, justice within schools or the way that teachers are treated or the way that employees are treated. These are big problems. So you can't ever have one person changing the world and you can't just use one concept within psychology. You've got to actually take a community approach. So that's what communities of practice really is.
Okay. And it kind of ends up with you working with lots of different types of groups. So, yeah. You know, you talked about schools and workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favourite sort of environment to work in?
Oh, don't make me choose.
No.
Look,
if you're willing to choose between your children, which I know you are, then you should be able to choose here.
Do you know, I think anywhere where there is a real, this is such a cliched phrase, but diversity of thought, like lots of different viewpoints on things is exciting.
Yeah.
I mean my first love was working in schools because there's such incredibly such an incredible variety of thought in schools. You've like, who's the stakeholder, who's the customer?
Yeah,
like it's so difficult to know. Is it the child? Is it the parents because they choose that school? Is it the parent? Is it their staff because they choose to work there? Is it the wider community because this is the workforce that's being educated and then they're going to go out into the workforce? Like, who is it? The governors? Is it Ofsted? So that, because there are so many different stakeholders, mm-hmm. that's why for me schools are really interesting. And then at the core of it, you've got these incredible beings who are just developing and growing and really receptive to new ideas. The children, that is.
Yeah, I got that.
You got that bit. You got that bit. And so, just developmentally, I find that really exciting that you can form relationships with families and with children over time and just see the changes so exponentially.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was I started off as an educational psychologist.
So at schools, really? Yes, it
I'm
is.
I'm not going to say that because actually, do you know the interesting thing about schools is that some of the work that I'm doing now is broader than the school system itself. And so it's thinking about things like social media and working with charities in partnership with schools as to how do we ensure that children are safe with social media? How are they getting out there and being more involved in things that are not screens? How do we support them to develop better relationships? And that's beyond the school as well. So schools plus.
Schools plus. And it must be very different because I always think of schools as being very pure. Kids are, the great thing about kids is they're setting out in the world and they're just forming their views. And those views are being coloured, unfortunately, by adults. But at that point, that's why they ask great questions, right? Because their filter is not, oh, this is acceptable, this is not acceptable.
They have
no filter, right? And so they'll say, why do you look like that? Or why does that person, why is this person mean to that person? You know, when you step from doing in that environment to what is a very different environment in businesses especially, what's the difference? You know, it must feel very, very different from a psychologist's perspective.
Mm-hmm. You'd think it would.
Hmm.
It isn't actually all that different.
Yeah, I've encountered a lot of children in the world.
It really isn't. I'm going to be really upfront about it. Yeah. I don't find it that different because I think a lot of models and dynamics of groups of people, they emulate the initial one, kind of that family dynamic. And schools emulate that. So you've got that hierarchy of the head teacher and this and that and the other. Mm-hmm. And then when you go into the workplace. Exactly.
Of it, yes.
So the organisational part of it is so similar when you go into the workplace.
Right.
You know, having that CEO or having, you know, the board to stakeholders to be able to have to respond to having your, you know, the different levels of within the hierarchy of a workplace. And everyone's got their own viewpoints. Everyone comes together to get something done and then they go home back into their own environments. So they're bringing their own life experiences into the workplace as well. And that I find is the real similarity. It's humans everywhere you go. It's just humans humaning.
Yes.
And so when you've got that and we're trying to constrain people into doing a particular job or showing up in a particular role, we've got to make sure that we're holding them holistically in mind, not just the role that they're there to do, but who they are outside of that. And how do we ensure that we're supporting them to show up in the best way possible, given the other stuff that's going on for them?
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed it many times, but, you know, your child in the school or your employee in the workplace, creating the right environment and culture for them is psychologically is very, very similar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you learn and execute in a school for creating a great vibe in the school, for want of a better term, it's totally can be repeated in the workplace, right?
Exactly the same. Exactly the same. And I could go even further to start talking about inner child stuff and lots of psychoanalytic views of how we don't really grow up in all aspects as we move through life. There's quite a lot of unconscious stuff that continues as we grow up and we interact in similar ways, you know, from when we were young to when we get older in childhood.
Yeah, you know. So when you tell people to work to grow up, that's actually the right thing to say.
I'd never say that.
Hey, just grow up, will you? You know. Okay, cool. We'll come back to that later on, I think. But we like to start at the beginning here, on Road to the Top, with what makes you you.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Birmingham. I'm saying Birmingham, Midlands or actual Birmingham?
Actual
Birmingham. Whereabouts of Birmingham?
South Birmingham, Kings Heath.
Okay, Kings Heath in Birmingham. Okay. So can you tell me what it was like growing up as a person of colour in Kings Heath in Birmingham?
Oh, wow. So this is 80s.
Okay. All right. You look good.
Thank you. I'll take that.
Yeah. And so you should.
All the way back in the 80s. So 80s Birmingham. So let me just start off. I started off where we lived initially up until about kind of 8, 9, was a very, I'd say a very white area. In Kings Heath, and an area, you know, that I suppose demographically it wasn't, you know, people, there was a lot of social housing in that area. It was a very working class area. We lived opposite a factory, and we lived in one of the few houses that were privately owned on that road. It was lots of public housing, government housing. And the first school I went to was very Wasn't very diverse as a school. I was one of very few black children.
Very few, like a handful, 5, 10?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's in the school.
Right. not in the whole school, not in the year group.
Okay. Yeah, that was in the school. And over time, things did become more diverse in that area. But the second school I moved to, I think, was slightly more diverse. It was, I think...
Secondary school, is this?
No. My second primary school. Okay. So, we moved house halfway through. So we moved to an area that was a bit more in the suburbs of South Birmingham, and I moved school at that time. So a little bit more diverse. And I think that school had a little bit more ambition for all children. I remember in the first school, if my mum ever listens to this, she'll
I hope she will.
I don't know if she'll bristle or if she'll smile, I don't know.
Or you heard it here
first.
Might
traumatise her. But I remember her feeling that when in the first school in particular, that was quite a white working class area, I was being held back.
Right.
When I started school, I could read already. My mum worked part-time and she invested a lot in kind of education. Educating me and ensuring that I could read, I could do basic number work. And so when I started school, I could do all of those things. And I remember her having to convince the head teacher that I could read. And there was a conversation with the class teacher who wanted me to read a particular book. And I was convinced I've already read that book. I already read it in the school. And she was like, no, you need to go back because everybody else is on that book. So you need to do this one. And I was, my mum was livid. She's like, no, she has read that book and she needs to move on to the next one. So I then had to, because they couldn't just let it go and say, okay, put her on the next book. I had to go and prove that I could read well to the head teacher.
Yeah.
Called me in one day and I had to go and read for him before they would let me move on to the next books. I remember when I left, I remember my mum saying there was a year six teacher, didn't teach me directly, but had taught my brother previously.
Yeah.
But he said it's the best move that you're going to make moving from this school in terms of just looking at a child, nurturing a child and wanting them to move on. And if ever you wanted your daughter to go to like a grammar school, which I eventually did, she's not going to get it here. Because actually it's whatever is good enough is what we do at this school. And so I moved on to the next primary school and then was able to move into grammar school.
Yeah.
So that's kind of schooling, but holistically in Birmingham, I had a really nurturing, warm family, lots of extended family. My family are Jamaican heritage. So
okay. First generation.
So mum and dad are both first generation. So they came over to the UK as children. And so their parents were...
As children, they came over.
Yeah.
So Windrush, or was that pre...
So Windrush-ish. So my grandparents came over, not on the Windrush, but that generation of coming over to work. So both maternal and paternal grandparents came over to work to fill those jobs. And then they were in that situation. You may have come across this many of those elders came over in that generation, left their children in the Caribbean, and then eventually brought them over as they were teenagers, and then they had to integrate into the UK system here. So yes, but lovely. I had a real strong upbringing and a real connection with my culture.
Yeah.
And I knew that I was Caribbean, but more than that, I knew I was Jamaican, and I knew I was very, whether it was the food or the songs or just the traditions. I remember birthdays, and this might be something that will make my mum chuckle if she remembers. Birthdays, I don't know, why did we do it? we'd have parties at home and I would be in the middle and we'd sing Brown Girl in the Ring, tra-la-la-la-la.
Yeah, I love that.
Looks like a sugar in a flum. Mm. So I all of that. And also my mum was a poet. So she really instilled in me.
Was she she was not a professional poet?
No, but part-time, well, amateur.
Okay.
She went around and did performances. One of her performances that I remember, and as a child, I'd go around to these performances. She performed at The Cave, which was a place in Moseley in Birmingham, black-owned performance space. And I remember her doing an interpretation of Winnie Mandela.
Yeah.
So there was her as Winnie Mandela, and then she had a friend who was Louise Bennett from Jamaica, and then another friend who was Harriet Tubman. And so they'd go around, the three of them, Sisters in Unity. Oh my gosh, I can't remember. I remember that. They were called Sisters in Unity. And they'd do these monologues.
Like a pop band.
Oh my gosh, they were better than the pop band. But I just remember just feeling very comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah.
Because even if whichever places I went to, whether in my first school, second school, like I knew I had this core of belongingness within my culture. So I felt really comfortable in my own skin.
So that sounds great. But there's this duality, isn't there? Because I just say, you know, I knew I was, I am Jamaican, right? Mm-hmm. But really, you are British as well. So, and we have this discussion a lot on this podcast, you can imagine, this whole idea of being two things that are quite different. How did that sense of identity as being British or Jamaican, I mean, were you I'm very much one or the other, or did you invent your own British Jamaicanness, or how did you feel your sense of identity? Because it sounds like it was very strongly Caribbean.
Yeah, for sure. And do you know, I don't think I ever felt the pressure to choose.
Right.
I think both were nurtured in respective ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most defining moments was when I was 7 and my parents made the decision to go back to Jamaica for the first time. That was their first time going back since they were children.
Well, on holiday?
Yeah. Okay. So we went for, I think it was Easter, for about a month.
Okay.
So it was a good chunk of time in a 7-year-old's mind. Yeah. And I remember, and I think for me, that was one of the most important things they ever did to solidify my connection with my country of heritage.
Yeah.
So we stayed in Kingston, so, you know, the city, but we also stayed in the country, which was where they were from. And I was running around chasing chickens and catching little fireflies or peeny wallies with my cousins. And I had a real sense of, this is where you are from, you know? So even though I was still, you know, in the UK watching daytime TV and in the school system and dancing to pop songs and, you know, all of the rest of it that was very British in my small world as a 7-year-old, I knew that there was something very different from this community that I still was able to access and feel part of.
Yeah.
And so I embraced that duality, and it felt like there were enough situations for that duality to embrace me.
Yeah.
So I remember when I came back to school after that journey, that first journey to Jamaica, and we had to take a few days off school, and my mum had to write that letter in. And, you know,
not as bad as these days. You tell you'd be fined.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We would have been. But one of the things was that I had to do a project. And so my mum made me do this project of collecting the postcards of things and actually taking this seriously. This is my exploration into my current country of heritage into my identity. And I remember bringing it back to the school and had to present it to the class, and they were learning. So, you know, I was teaching them stuff that they wouldn't, so far outside of their sphere of existence, but I had experienced it and was sharing it with them. So I felt the duality could coexist.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's super interesting. And that didn't impact, because, you know, kids have no filter and they're not cruel, so and they can be cruel. And so there was no issue with you saying, this is my home, even though I'm here in Birmingham, with people going, well, because it's quite funny, you know, the old thing was, you need to go home. You know, black people, you should go home. But if you're sort of saying, this is, there was like, but this is my home.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. I always find it super interesting when people was like, you know, home was Jamaica or Africa or Nigeria or wherever, but this was my home.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. The question is, did you encounter any issues or problems with that as a identity thing at school?
I think as I got a little bit older, there were instances of that.
Mm.
I think that the thing that always helped me not really feel it as much was that there was such, I mean, Birmingham community was definitely a multicultural community. And it felt like even more so in the 80s, you know, the whole musical youth thing.
Yeah,
and
it's true.
You know,
Past the Duchy.
Exactly.
On the left-hand side.
Exactly. So all those things were happening. And you know, the part of my family are from Handsworth. Yeah, right. Big up to the Pinckney crew. They're from Handsworth. And so, you know, just being able to navigate that helped me to just have a real sense of belonging. But the time that I felt a little bit uneasy was when I got to secondary school. So I was in this grammar school situation. Again, quite, there was a handful of diversity. I'd say I more gravitated to, there were more children from Asian backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up gravitating more to them as well as to the children from black backgrounds too. Yeah. And obviously those from white other backgrounds. Yeah. But I remember distinctly there being times within secondary school around form time, PSHE, I think they call it. And we often started, I remember there being conversations around diversity and racism. And I just remember feeling that burning sensation of all eyes being on me, like when we're having the race conversation. It's like nobody was doing it, but I just kind of felt like, whoa. Everyone's kind of, you know, that everyone's waiting to see what's she going to say, because like we're talking about black people. What's she going to say about it? And I remember there being, I remember having, feeling like I had to stand up for a conversation that was taking place. And with hindsight, I think as a teacher, there could have been a better consideration of how to keep a child who is a black child in this conversation that we're having about race. How could I keep her safe? How could I, do you know, I think there could have been a bit more thought about that. But I had to explain to the rest of the group why it might feel different to be a minority.
Yeah.
Because they didn't quite get it. And we were talking about racism. And I remember some of the white children in the school, this is when we were about 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, you know, I've seen black people can be very racist towards white people. And do you know, how is it any different? It's not any different. And was kind of waxing lyrical about this. And I remember feeling as though I had to take a stand.
Yeah,
I mean, the other alternative is I could have just said nothing.
Correct.
And let them carry on. Because the teacher wasn't saying anything.
Yeah.
But I felt the need to correct this way of thinking at that age.
Yeah.
And it felt like a responsibility, whereas everybody could just show up and be themselves. I was representing everybody else. Yeah. I was representing, you know, everybody from the Caribbean, from Africa, everybody who's mixed race. I was representing everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But it felt as though I was at the time.
And you are. And actually, it's one of those things professionally, even in the workplace, it still is very tough for people of colour who get into leadership roles and stuff. The same sort of thing, because they're often having to represent for everyone else, having to explain for everyone else.
Yeah.
In the same way that you had to as a child.
Yeah, exactly.
It kind of never goes away.
Yeah, unfortunately.
You know, unfortunately at the moment. Cool. So it sounds like the schooling and the school system and education kind of worked out okay for you.
It did.
You know,
it did.
Which is...
Not going to lie.
Which is good. And although it shaped representing, it doesn't sound like being a person of colour in the schooling system held you back. At all?
No.
An interesting thing that you say there about, that I hear a lot about, is about education and the importance of education for people of colour going, you know, who, especially first, maybe second generation, as a thing that your parents focus on. It sounds like your parents were incredibly focused on your education.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they weren't pushy in terms of education. I was just one of those children.
It's important.
Yeah, about the importance, definitely. Yeah. But, you know, as always, someone that I wanted to learn. I was that child that wanted to read. I was that child.
Okay.
Maybe a bit of a geek when you look back now, I was that child.
Right.
But at the same time, I was very much interested in the arts as well. I said my mum was a poet, and so I loved writing, I loved reading, I loved dance and art. And I had an uncle who was a photographer, my late uncle, who was a stickler for education, but he was also a photographer. And his topic of choice was actually Indian dance.
All right.
Which was really interesting. So again, just exploring more about diversity and cultures and learning more. I mean, I remember learning about Kathak dance when I was growing up and going to his exhibitions, going up to Nottingham and seeing other communities of people who weren't necessarily born here or representing other countries. It just being a really enriching environment to grow up in.
Yeah, it does. But this importance of education that parents have, especially these parents had, mine very, very similar, and almost everyone that sat in that seat has talked about how their parents were like, this is the thing you can have, that your life's going to be interesting, but if you've got an education, you've got somewhere to start. Even people who are getting excluded and stuff, their parents are still, you've got to get your education, you've got to get your education. And it's something you see a lot, I think, in Afro-Caribbean families. Pretty much all underrepresented groups. I think that's the focus. So if that was your parents and they focused that on you, and even though you wanted to learn anyway, so you were a good child from that perspective, what other things did your parents tell you back then about how this was going to work out for you? You know, what are you thankful that they told you now that maybe you wouldn't have been at the time, you know?
Oh, wow. It was the put your head to your lesson situation, you know, but where's your book? You know, have you done your homework? And I think even, you know, my both my parents, my dad, I remember him, you know, letting me off doing chores because I had homework to do and stuff. Like, you know, you don't have to do the washing up. You've got work to do. So, I mean, that was important. But I'd say, looking back, one of the things, I mean, you asked kind of what are some of the things that they said that I didn't quite connect with then, but I do
or
now.
Or you're thankful.
Or that I'm thankful for. That's a tough one.
Okay, let me ask a more direct question, which is, you know, we sit and talk a lot on this podcast about parents telling you, well, one, education, two, effort. So you'll work harder, you have to do more. Did your parents, and actually, because we all, you and I, we all have to refactor that for what we tell our own children, right? Mm. And part of my journey to here today was actually that conversation with my daughter when I was saying, you know, you have to put it in, you have to work hard, you have to be the best, you have to make it undeniable that you are the right person for this job or performing in that way. Mm-hmm. And that made me kind of reflect that was what I was told as well. Mm-hmm. Were you told anything like that? And or do you tell your kids anything like that?
So I think the message of, there's a phrase that my late grandmother used to say, which is about being good, better, best.
Yeah.
I will never rest until my good is better and my better best.
Nice.
So this idea of, you know, the race is not against other people. The race is actually with yourself to get to optimize what you are doing and not pay attention to what other people are doing. That was certainly instilled. That to really be focused, really focused on moving on. And I think, you know, they did take it a little bit further. Like I had quite a number of friends when I was at school and used to like speaking on the house phone. Obviously it's going to be the house phone and that, because that's what we had.
No mobiles then.
So I remember like distinctly my dad saying, you know, your friends aren't going to get you further. They're not going to get you on. I mean, conversely, what I found is now as an adult in my career, actually, it's your network that really does operationalise stuff so for you. They were wrong. but I think they were right insofar as forming that foundation.
Mm-hmm.
It really was about being very focused and competing with yourself, and where you can put in more effort and get a higher return, do it.
Mm.
No kind of half-assed, mediocre ways of doing things. Like if you can be better than you were a day ago, you do it.
Yeah.
So I thank them for that. And I have definitely instilled that in my kids as well.
Yeah. unedited, the exact same message, or modernized?
There might be a bit of an upgrade or an update, slightly. So an example. Yeah. So my 11-year-old came home. first term of secondary school, first time doing Spanish, he came home, he'd got 97% in his Spanish exam.
Right.
And I was like, wow, you know, you've really taken to this and really super proud of you. There was a little part of me that was like, what happened to the 3%?
There always is,
I didn't go there.
Right,
I didn't
good,
go there.
Good.
But when he's got other tests or exams, he's like, yeah, I'll just have a look at lunchtime. I'm like, absolutely not.
Mm.
You, and I remind him, and maybe this is an unedited thing that they used to do as well.
Yeah.
I remind him of where he was, that he was this child that, you know, my 11-year-old now, he was the child at nursery that used to bring a Brian Cox book into school and tell his friends all about the planets and
wow,
stuff. Like
right,
that, that's that child.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, he's a child that's had the pandemic to contend with and, you know, all these sorts of things, which I think changed a lot of motivation for children back then, particularly him. Mm-hmm. And so now I remind him a lot about his potential and who he is, who I know him to be. And, you know, when you're going to be revising for a test, it's not, we're not going to do it at lunchtime. Mm-hmm. We are going to do absolutely everything that we can do to get the maximum result that we can possibly get. So it is racing against yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in other children. If he comes back and says, oh, you know, everybody else got, they only got 50%, not interested.
Yeah.
I have zero interest in what everybody else got because I know you.
Ooh, you sound like so tough that.
But the thing is, otherwise we just end up in this mediocre space. And I don't think, and I think having boys has shifted things as well, because I kind of see within the UK the way that boys and men, black men, are often treated, that I'd say it's even more pertinent for them. And I know, I'm sorry, I'm speaking on your behalf as a black male UK. But I'm like, no, I want you to have that. I want you to have that belief in yourself, and also that the aspirations within yourself that you can do more, that you can do better, to aspire to be as best you can be. So that if anyone's coming with any other nonsense, you know it's not about your effort.
Yeah.
Because you've already maximized that. You know it's not about your ability because you've already tried to maximize that. So then you start thinking, well, what else could it be?
Yeah.
And then at least you can be secure in the knowledge that I've done everything I possibly can to show up and get a good outcome in whatever I'm putting my mind to.
That's very powerful, because it's often, you know, relative to someone else, you need to do better than them. What you're saying is you need to do your best, right? And your best is good enough. Your best is good enough.
It is.
And if that means you don't achieve the things, as long as you know that you've done the best you can do, then you've got nothing to leave behind. And obviously that's what your parents said to you. And you said they weren't pushy, but they were this about being your best. Did they want you to be anything in particular? You know, you're going through your university and did you study at university?
Psychology actually,
right. So no surprise. spoiler alert. So psychology, did they have a path that they wanted you to tread, or did they just leave it to you?
I think there was a lot of trust that I would, and I was, as I said, I was that kid. I went through the big book that before everything was online, before internet and stuff. We had the UCAS big book, went through every single profession. This is when I was 16, thinking, I don't know what I want to do. I want to do everything. And so when I got to uni, and then I realized I wanted to be an educational psychologist in particular, because I just loved the way that the brain works when you're learning new things.
Yeah.
And like, how does the brain learn new things? How does it absorb? I had to be, so in the old days, in old money, you had to become a teacher first.
Right.
So that's what I did. And so I think there was an expectation from my dad more so, that because I'm a teacher now, you're going to become a head teacher, because that's the pinnacle
the
of that. Exactly. You tread the ladder now, don't you? And so I think there was a bit of surprise when I didn't become a head, or I didn't want to become a head teacher. Like I had zero interest in becoming a head teacher.
Yeah.
I did the fast track teaching program when I was, I went and qualified as an undergraduate psychologist, and then went and did the year PGCE at Cambridge, and then came back to Birmingham and taught there for a few years.
Mm.
And I think the expectation was, she's going to be a head teacher. It was like, no, I've got my plan already. I'm applying for the MSc. I'm going to UCL.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and I'm being an educational psychologist. So that was a bit of a shock. So I think they wanted me to, whatever I was doing, to kind of max out where I was. So I think they were waiting for me to get this optional professional doctorate that I recently acquired. Even though I didn't need it to practice as a psychologist still, it was like, well, we know that this is available. Why aren't you doing it? I think it just mirrors what I was saying before about racing against yourself, and wherever you can see it, there is another level to get to. Why are you not doing it?
I probably haven't given you a full title, Doctor.
Oh, thank you.
You know, well, I should have really clarified that and made sure that it was okay for me to call you Stacey, not Dr. Stacey. You know, your parents must have been very proud when you got that, though.
They are, and they still are. It's one of those bragging rights, isn't it? Go speak to other.
But especially in our community, it's a very, very, very big thing.
It is. And I think particularly coming from a Caribbean background. When I completed the qualification, it really wasn't just for me. It was understanding the legacy of where my lineage had come from. And so it was a love letter to my grandparents. It was.
It was. Being a doctor, the love letter to your grandparents.
Yeah.
Love that. Okay, so doctor, but this is let's go back to when you're not a doctor. You've been to university. What the world of work and the world of work and you, we often go into this in your career. What was your first proper job? How did you get it? What was the impact of it?
Yeah, so I actually started working when I was 14.
Okay.
And I was a dance teacher, so loved dance and excelled in that. And the dance teacher
still do
became
it?
A not as much. Right. Not yeah, no, I don't do lessons or anything like that anymore. But yeah, in my head, I do. I hear a piece of music and I've got a whole dance routine.
Okay. You're a choreographer in your head.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
In your head.
In my head. There's a lot of things in my head. So I remember teaching children. Really loving that. But when you say proper job, I remember, you know, from there becoming a teacher and teaching secondary school and teaching English and psychology. And I remember being roped into, because I used to be a dance teacher and taught all these things and also taught a bit of gymnastics. Mm. They were like, right, you can come and join our PE department. We're down a teacher. So I remember having to teach PE as well. I was like, I thought I was just doing the dance module. They're like, no, you've got to teach basketball. You've got to teach this. I was like, I don't know.
You're a teacher.
I'm like, what? And so surely there were kids. Oh my gosh, this is a confession now. Some of them might see it.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. That is the point.
No, but then they'll realise that their basketball teacher did not have a clue.
I think they realised.
I think you're quite right. I think, you could not have not noticed that. And so, getting on with other people, learning more about how the world of work works, understanding how people, and it's how humans human, again, just the relationships, the interactions, the teamwork. And while I was there, so that teaching role, I was the lead for this thing called the Aiming High Project.
Okay.
And it was specifically about raising the attainment and recognizing the achievements of African Caribbean children in the school. And that was it felt like the right thing for me to do at the time. And I really enjoyed working on that project and met with some amazing people. Somebody who I would definitely describe as a mentor today, Rosemary Campbell Stevens, Rosemary Campbell Stevens now, who came in as a consultant. And I remember for the first time seeing somebody who was speaking to the whole school, senior leadership, you know, main grades as well, you know, and children, and was authentically herself.
Oh, wow.
And she was, I think, similar to me, of Caribbean heritage, Jamaican heritage, I think born in the UK, correct me if I'm wrong, Rosemary, but very much of her Caribbean heritage and made no excuses about bringing anecdotes that were very much connected to her heritage, being very direct, using metaphors that were very much from our community. And I was like,
wow,
that's
it's like a light bulb, isn't it? You know, yeah. you can be you in this setting.
Right. 100% that. And she gave me permission to be that. Not that I was seeking permission.
Yeah.
But it made it okay.
Yeah.
I mean, and just thinking about, you know, at that time in my life. So I hadn't started growing my locks yet.
All right.
This is an aside, but it is relevant.
No. We've always got to talk about hair.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
Let's go.
So I remember, and it was my dad actually, where I used to have my hair twisted or in braids. I had my hair natural, twisted in braids. And he was like, oh, maybe you might want to think about something a bit more professional.
Yeah.
And I remember us having this conversation, and when I started growing my locks again, it was like, so you're going to be a teacher with your hair like that? It was difficult for him to reconcile. Like, how can you show up as a professional? Is this going to impact on your opportunities?
Yeah.
Like, is that? But actually, this consultant that came in, she was unashamedly herself.
Yeah,
gave that 100% permission to be myself, and. Yeah, if ever I wanted to look towards somebody who was rocking it and being themselves, it was her.
So let's talk about that, because it's super important, because I think lots of people kind of have this sort of, can I be my authentic self? But and is my authentic self palatable to what I do? My son's got braids now, but he wants to be an investment banker, right? But will that work? I don't know. And we've had this discussion already. That discussion that you're having, we've had sort of thing. How do you think about that now? And what sort of advice do you give to people who are thinking about, can I be my authentic self in the workplace and get on?
I think I've got, because there are certain industries that I have worked adjacent to as opposed to inside. And I'm thinking about things like, you know, finance or insurance. And
I know about both of those.
You know about both of those. And they're more... I think there's a longer way to go, I think, for some conservative mindsets to accept not only are you black, but you've got the audacity to show up in your full blackness with your full afro. And you couldn't even just, you know, small it down a little bit and, you know, relax your hair a little bit or something. So I think there are certain industries where it's harder or potentially more difficult to show up authentically as yourself. But I think until we do it,
then it won't be
nothing's
going
to change. And I had an amazing conversation with a consultant called David McQueen just yesterday, and we were talking about exactly that, about how you show up authentically yourself. And we talked about it, you know, show up with your seasoning, with your little seasoning that is you, whether it is your braids or your locks, or, you know, showing up in a way that feels authentic, because then you can actually do your best work.
Mm-hmm.
When you're compromising on parts of yourself or changing parts of yourself in order to fit in, you are subconsciously then telling yourself that you can't show up whole.
Yeah.
If there are parts of you that you're deliberately going to leave behind, like if I was to have listened to that narrative from my dad and be like, oh yeah, you know what, let me go get a weave.
Yeah.
What am I doing?
Yeah.
Like what am I telling myself? How worthy I am to be in this space.
But the reality is, though, that's the truth. So code switching, we've discussed many times, is real. It's a real way that people have to navigate their life, personally sometimes, but almost certainly professionally. Mm-hmm. And we can't say it doesn't exist. It does. And it's a way forward. So how do you feel about it? I mean, have you ever had to do code switching?
I think some of them, my husband probably would say I code switch all the time.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like I'm a bit of a chameleon.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about kind of in the UK, but just internationally, I feel like I'm a very kind of global soul.
Yeah. Global citizen.
You know, wherever I go, there are certain phrases that are more easily heard. There are certain tonalities that are more easily heard or responded to. But when I give keynotes, I'm a fresh professional speaker as well. When I give keynotes, I will use the anecdotes that are relevant and pertinent to a Jamaican household, and I'll educate. I'll say, you know what, you're not going to know what this means, but in our house we would say, you know, this. One of the examples that I did in a keynote recently was about the good front room or the front room, and how sacred that is in a Caribbean household,
yep.
or was. You know, mm-hmm. things have changed. But in growing up, this was my experience.
That's where you meet people. When people come to your house, they go to the front room. They don't go to any other room.
Exactly.
That's it.
But then as a child, what am I doing in there?
Yeah.
I'm not going in there. Yeah. Am I using the glasses that are in this cabinet? That's it. Absolutely not.
No.
And so, you know, educating people about, you know, my reality and explaining kind of narratives about where I'm coming, where I come from, I think it brings people in and it mm-hmm. forms a connection. But insofar as code switching, I think when you're with your friends and when you're very relaxed and you're coming from a certain background, maybe there'll be certain words of patois that I would use and it will be understood, or there'll be certain facial expressions that we use and it will be understood. There's a culture.
I know you can do that. I know you know? Can wagwan. You know.
Dear. Okay. What are we gonna do?
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Though you can. We all have to. We have to. Part of the podcast is so people realize that this is what people have to do. You know that it happens, and it's not necessarily a massive hardship for you or for me, but it's real. You know, we do.
Yeah.
We are maybe different with a group of friends and family than we would be in the workplace.
Yeah, but I think everybody does it. I think everybody, well, I'm convinced that everybody does it. Maybe there is, you know, a particular demographic that doesn't have to do it, but I'm convinced that everybody does it, which I think is why you might find certain people who are saying things, they feel quite comfortable with their friendship group.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they come to the workplace and they're towing the line and they are code switching and not using, you know, racial slurs. I think I'm talking about, I think largely people of the white majority,
mm-hmm.
that they know certain things aren't going to be tolerated in the workplace. And so they're code switching as well. But when they go back to their comfortable place of people that kind of think like them, or, you know, did you see it? You know, those sorts of asides, they do that in the comfort of their own environment. And I think we also do too, in that, you know, there's certain things that would make us laugh or make us smile, or and we will, you know, we're comfortable in that. When you're in, and it comes back to culture and belongingness and social groups, I think. So I think we all do code switch. It's just that for us, maybe, or for many of us, you know, coming first or second generation, coming from other areas, maybe the switch of code is maybe a little bit more of a leap than for others.
Yeah.
But as long as we've got place, I feel anyway, where we've got places that we feel comfortable with outside of the workplace, and if we don't feel like we are compromising
mm-hmm.
the message that we're trying to give, or compromising our values and beliefs in the workplace, it's all good.
It's all fair game.
Yeah.
You know, no, I think it's a super interesting thing, and it's something that I think is important to people that are growing up. As our children will have to think hard about this too. And wouldn't it be amazing that if we lived in a world where you could just be a colleague used to call it full fat rather than diet, right? You can be full fat yourself rather than diet yourself. But your point, that's not, it's definitely a thing around race, 100%. But there's other things that people have to do.
And do you know, if I just say further to that point, I had the opportunity of working in Jamaica for 3 months as a psychologist, which was through Grace Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
At the start of my career. And I think it was that was really important and defining for me, to be in a corporate culture in Jamaica and then a more relaxed, informal culture in Jamaica, because there's code switching that goes on there too.
Yeah.
And it is more about the environments that you're in as opposed to it being to do with race.
Yeah.
Because there's certain language, I mean, they're very, very, you know, prim and proper and within the office. And then when you see the same CEO out at the beach at the weekend, it's a different, that code switch has been made.
Yeah.
And it's to do with the environment that you're in. If we're in a business environment, we will use standard English. We will, you know, this is the way that we'll conduct ourselves. But when we're in a relaxed environment, actually, absolutely fine.
It's, we'll move on, but it's this term professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
Like what does that actually mean? Mm. And what does it mean to different people? I've seen incredibly brilliant people in the workplace who I would say some of the language was unprofessional, but everything they said and they did and it was absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they push the boundaries, they push the barriers to what becomes acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be unacceptable not to wear a tie. That I lived in a time where if you came in without a tie, that was unprofessional.
Yeah.
You know, you could wear a suit and a shirt and shoes.
Yep.
No tie makes you unprofessional.
Yes.
So it's amazing how things change and things shift.
It's
culture. What is professional and what's not professional.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of progression, one of the things that I think about a lot is, and we discussed, resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had any significant setbacks in your career to date, and how did you deal with them?
Oh, that is a good question. So, I haven't spoken about this openly, actually.
Nice.
So,
one of the
juicy
one. That.
So, a setback happened quite early on in my doctorate. My professional doctorate, and I'd started my own business at the time as well. I was thinking about starting my own business. I was working for a local authority at the time. And I decided, one of my best friends was getting married in India.
Mm-hmm.
And she invited me to the wedding. I obliged, never been to India. Went by myself, went and joined the groom's family over there. And as a strange series of coincidences would have it,
mm-hmm.
I ended up a hostage at the Taj in India, in Mumbai.
A hostage mm-hmm. of?
A terrorist situation.
What?
In Mumbai. So the 2008 terrorist incident happened and
oh my God,
I was
and
there.
You were in there?
Yeah.
Wow. You okay talking about this?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm okay talking about it now. Enough time has passed. And so definitely a life-changing moment. Thankfully, all of us who were there in our party, we were fortunate enough to all come out unscathed.
Yeah.
We were very, very, very... We could do the rest of this podcast with verys, but lucky, blessed, whatever. It was an absolute miracle.
Yeah.
But obviously there were people that didn't.
Mm.
It was a very shaky moment.
Mm.
And I went from being somebody who supports mental health
mm-hmm.
in environments, in communities, in schools, wherever, to needing that help myself.
Yeah.
And that was difficult. I don't think I realized how difficult that would be.
Yeah.
To be on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, you've done all your training. You know all the things. You know.
You're
you
a
know
psychologist,
all this.
You know
exactly.
It all.
I know how this is going to plan out. I know how this is going to work.
Yeah.
So I could support other people. I know how to support other people, but to receive the support myself was tough.
Wow.
And I remember, you know, having a very very compassionate local authority. I was working for Hackney at the time, and they were very, very kind, very gracious in and being very sensitive in how do we facilitate this person coming back?
Mm.
And at the same time, I was doing my had started my professional doctorate, and again, very gracious, very kind in giving the space and time that was necessary. And so for me, that resilience was about stepping forward and being able to take the support that was never needed prior,
right.
Accepting that there had been a major setback mm-hmm. that I, you know, fundamentally you're not quite ever going to be the same,
no.
You know, having been through a very traumatic experience, and you have to find a way to then navigate the world, where you know you had done so differently before, you have a different understanding of I think of how precious life is, how limited time could be, how grateful you are to just be alive, but also that real sense of responsibility on your shoulders to make something of this life, to have an impact, to have an influence, because life is just so incredibly precious.
It is.
And so, so it took a degree of humility mm-hmm. to step back. I know we've spoken about that term before in some of the work that we've done together, but this idea of humility to, all right, where are we starting from here? And to become more self-reflective, to take more time for my own mental health going forward proactively, and to just to have a real grasp of how fragile our mental health really is. And it can take one incident or instance for things to just really shift in a moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I know it can't be easy. And it's that old adage of, or is it the question it should be, you know, almost pertinent words, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? As a result of that and that resilience and that humility and stepping through that, do you think that made you a stronger person?
Yeah, as if I didn't already have that background of parents saying you're competing much, you know, get to the best of you are. It absolutely did. It absolutely did. And of course, there are days that you know, over time passes and, you know, you get into your old habits of, you know, life is just life.
Yeah.
But it's a stark memory that will, you know, it will never really go away.
No.
I mean, every year, the group of us that were there, we actually still text each other, like, how you doing?
Yeah,
it's nice. All good. So once a year, we do check in. And that's a real beautiful thing to know that this thing that connected us, you know, we remember it.
And we'll always connect you.
And yeah, and we pay homage to the people that didn't make it. And yeah.
Wow. I've asked that question a lot. Never had an answer like that. So yeah.
There you go.
Thank you. Thinking about this, as we move on to the last part of what we're going to talk about, which is the work.
Yeah.
Has race ever been an issue in your career, do you think?
It depends what you mean by the word issue.
Yeah, okay.
And I think...
Define it the way you want to.
Yeah, so I know race definitely comes into when I show up at places. So going way back to, you know, the first organizations that I spoke about that I used to work in, so schools.
Yeah.
When I turn up for meetings, when I turn up for consultations or assessments, it's very frequent that I'm considered to either be the parent or the social worker.
All right. Okay.
I know I've got colleagues who are
not
older
Dr.
than me.
Stacey Moore.
Absolutely not. No. It's like she can't be the psychologist. So, and I have older colleagues, one in particular who talks about when he turned up to a school, he's a black male psychologist, and he was assumed to be like the caretaker or the cleaner. Yeah. It was like, what? And so those things, I think the frequency with which those things happen, I think it communicates, people's expectations of where you may be when you are melanated when you're showing up in this skin. And it's not necessarily, I mean, it's not racism per se. It's the expectation of what you may well be. It's a stereotype based on what you see in the frequency, which we may see people who look like you in various roles. So I understand that, you know, from a psychological process, that's a shortcut that people are using. And so, you know, in the past I used to just not say anything because it was just, it was the administrative staff or the reception staff that would be receiving me.
Yeah.
That'd be like, oh, you know, are you the parent? Are you mum? I'm like, no. but, you know, I would say no and then correct them. But in the past, I might not have corrected them. They'd be like, oh, you know, oh, here she comes in. In you go. So the social worker's here. I hear them on hear the reception on the phone. Oh, the social worker's here. And I might not have corrected them.
Yeah.
Now I always do. Because I see that as an opportunity to shift that stereotype that person has. And it's not because I think that one is better than the other or one is, it's not about that. It's just about creating an image of, this is what a psychologist looks like.
Yeah.
You know, braids and all.
Can
or,
look like.
Or locks and it's, all. Can look like.
Can
yeah.
look like.
Yeah. And so I'm now shifting your perspective as to who you think I am and what you think, you know, that on first glance, what's the first thing, the automatic thing your brain does? I'm creating an opportunity where it might go somewhere different.
Yeah.
Not overnight.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also happened, you know, when I did a speaking gig where I had to go down to Brighton and the car came to collect me and another delegate. And the person I was speaking to, I'd been invited to be the speaker from a psychological perspective. Mm-hmm. And the delegate assumed that I was part of the organizing team, that I was, you know, the runner or he was like, oh, you know, what's the agenda today? And what, you know, what's going on? The way he spoke was, I mean, it wasn't particularly rude, but it was, you could tell there was a hierarchy in his mind that he was working with in the way that he was speaking to me. But I was like, oh, no, I'm the keynote speaker. He was like, oh, Okay. And again, I like when those moments happen.
Yeah.
Because it means I'm challenging your automatic thought. Yeah. And the more that those things can happen, hopefully you're not going to do that again. You're not going to make the automatic assumption because you've had an experience where there was somebody who wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, that fitting that stereotype.
And the more that happens is why we do this podcast, right? Yeah. Is so that it can help rewire people who are not bad people.
No.
But the stereotypes exist.
Yeah.
And none of us, you know, are without having some view of stereotypes. Mm-hmm. None of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's really important, though, that we can rewire some of those stereotypes.
Yeah.
Just so that it doesn't become shocking that I'm the CEO of a company or you're the keynote speaker. It just can be.
Exactly. You know? Which is why I'm so disappointed to hear about all of these changes that are happening at the moment in the States with EDI work just being decimated and, you know, huge, huge companies saying, nah, we'll can that. And I'm concerned about the message that sends out to everybody else, to all companies, you know, the US, as the US sneezes, the UK catches a cold.
Yeah.
So, you know, that rhetoric, I think I'm concerned about that because with it packaged within really good EDI training is that understanding of difference and unpacking stereotypes and looking at bias. That's what makes up that training and creating psychological safety for everybody. You know, and so to do away with that, I think it means that there'll be less situations where people can challenge some of those stereotypes that they have.
Yeah, I, you know, we're into this now, and I was going to ask about institutional racism, but before we do that, let me just answer that or comment on what you've just said, because I think good companies will always do the work,
mm-hmm.
right? They may have to do it in a different way because the environment they exist in,
mm-hmm.
right? So I was talking to someone from a big American bank just yesterday, and they were like, this is real. The environment that's occurring with the re-election of Trump and stuff means that this is an environment that this organization has to navigate, right? Yeah. And to navigate this to this, we might have to do things differently. But actually, do we still value inclusivity? Do we still value talent? And yeah, we do. We might call it different things. So I've already seen EDI, DEI, now shifting towards belonging as a softer term that people are more, you know, can help them navigate different things. So I'm concerned, but in a way I'm not concerned because poor companies were always poor companies and maybe they do, but good companies will always remain good companies, well run. Yeah. Our job, my job, is to try and get more people to be in the good company situation than the poor one. But having said all of that, this whole concept of barriers and institutional racism. What are your views on it generally? I know we work together on trying to do something, but I'm really keen to understand more or communicate, for you to communicate more. How do you think we can change that?
Mm.
Assuming you think it exists.
Yeah. No, of course it doesn't. Yeah.
And your psychological perspective on it too.
Yeah, it's a big question. It is, and I know everybody that you've had on this. I mean, you tell me, has there been anybody that said, well, this is how we solve it?
No, there hasn't.
And I think it's, do you know, I think I'd be surprised if ever you get anyone that does do that, because it is, because of the way that institutional racism has been constructed over time, to dismantle it is going to take such a huge length of time.
Is it even possible? I mean, the way the brain, so give me your psychological view, the way the brain works and how you grow up and how your biases get introduced to your mind, and is it even possible?
I'm not going to say no.
No.
Because otherwise, what are we here for? Correct. I've got to have hope and I've got to have some faith that things can change. Because I think things already are.
Yeah.
And it's about finding those systems where things have changed, mm-hmm. and finding a way to make that spread. And it does come into that wider understanding of belongingness. Mm. But we have to be prepared to do the work. And that's why I sigh a little bit, because I think when you have those messages of, it's all right, we don't have to do EDI work or DEI work, we don't have to do that anymore. I think that the will to do that, then it dissipates when, you know, the unfortunate murder of George Floyd, when that happened, suddenly there was this fervor of, yeah, we've got to do this work. We've got to understand where racism has come from. We've got to dismantle it. We've got to do our bit. We've got to be white allies. There was that real passion towards the work.
Was there?
I think there was. There was a passion towards being seen to do the work.
Ah, different.
Yeah. And by, if people are being seen to do the work, you've got to do something. You know, even if you're not really doing it, just having that message of we need to be seen to be doing it gives permission for people to do it. When there's no consensus on, you know, we need to be seen to be doing it, then, well, I really don't have to do anything. And, you know, it's not going to lose me any points at all if I don't do it. Mm. Whereas at least where it was seen as important to be seen to be doing the work, if I do the work, that's aligned. Mm. But now I think we're getting to territory where, well, the apathy is co-signed, whereas before the apathy wasn't.
Yeah.
At that moment.
Because that's the reality. Companies that say, oh, we don't have to do that anymore, never really wanted to do it anyway.
No, they didn't.
Right?
And that's all right.
They wanted to be seen to be doing it,
is my point. Yeah,
but
that's okay. That's all right. You didn't think it was important. But the changes that you could make could open doors for so many other people than before. And like, you don't have to, in your heart of hearts, feel any differently about black people. Let's be very simple, simplistic in our language. But if you are saying that you're going to make a concerted effort to think about your suppliers, and you're going to make a concerted effort to ensure that there is a diversity within your suppliers, as opposed to, well, just whoever comes through the door comes through the door, or it's my mate or his mate, and actually all of us on the board are white, so all our mates are more likely to be white than others, then nothing shifts.
No.
You know, so I think, you know, there are two things here, and I think you're quite right to make that distinction about being seen to do the right thing and actually feeling like I've got to change and I take on some sort of this responsibility or accountability for the way that things are. No one's asking for the latter. People are asking for change. Like, if you've done some reading, if you want to go and read some, you know, why I'm no longer talking to white people about race, or you want to read some other books and overread, or, you know, if you want to go and do that reading, fine. But if your system permits for there to be more equity in who gets opportunities, then great. But I don't need you to feel that you have changed who you are, because there's a mandate that you have to do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I'm not asking you to like me as an individual, but I'm asking for the organization to recognize the disparities that exist within things such as race, gender pay gap. I'm asking you to recognize the disparities and then be committed to doing something different. That's what I'm asking for.
Mm. But the why is important, right? So you can recognize it and do something about it, but you have to... Don't the organisations have to have a why? They have to feel that it's important, because it change is hard.
Yeah.
Every type of change in human nature is hard.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And the thing that makes it, nothing makes it easier, but the thing that makes it easier is to have a real why.
Yeah.
Right. And so if they don't have a why individually, organisationally, not much is going to happen, right?
Yeah. And I think the why is going to be different for different people.
That's fine.
Yeah, which is fine. If your why is, well, if I don't do this, I'm not going to get a bonus, then that's your why.
Yeah.
But if the why is, do you know what? I've learnt. So that'll be more like a behavioural thing. It's a behavioural shift. If it's more of a cognitive, emotional shift, and you're like, actually, I've read this stuff now, and I now understand how organisations have got to be so white, and I now feel like I have a responsibility to change and shift and do things differently. The outcome of X organization is still going to be the same for diverse suppliers. But where it might be different is when you're making decisions between this person and that person, and your bias takes over and you kind of think, well, I'm not going to go for that person because I don't quite trust what they're like. Mm-hmm. We've never had a black person in this role before, or, you know, have black people in this role, then they're going to leave, aren't they? Or they've got certain issues that they might have. And my hope is that if we can get more people on boards and on executive levels who are on, you know, C-suite levels who have done the work, who do get the why. It's really important for them to get the why and for them to then be employing people in the whole organization that can connect with the messages that they're giving.
Yeah.
And it happens over time. So like you said, that the psychology behind transition and change, it is tough, but the messages have to be repeated. It can't just be, oh, today we have to do this particular way of hiring. It's mandated. The messages have to be repeated over time and in lots of different situations. As I said, I mean, I've given two examples around how you bring in your suppliers, but also how you bring in your employees, who you recruit, how you recruit, where you go to find your employees. There's so many things that have to shift, but the why can be surface level. But the thing that definitely has to change is from that higher level, that why needs to be emotional and cognitive, not just behavioral.
Okay. So to bring us to the conclusion, I always ask people, and I think you've touched on it, you know, with all of the, we always touch this at the end and then have to think about, but things can change, right? So why should we be hopeful that this will change and that it will be different for my kids and your kids?
Oh, I lie awake at night thinking of that very question.
Good, then we might.
No, I think now more than ever, I think we need to recognise that the UK is not the centre of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are able to connect with other places on this earth and feel comfortable showing up in those places and bring back practices from other places in the world, I think then things will shift. I mean, it might be a bit of a left field answer, but I've got a real obsession with leveraging the Britishness that you have here and taking it elsewhere and then bringing back the various learnings that you have from other cultures, from other societies, from other nationalities to enrich what's going on here. I think we've got stuck in this country. I think we've got stuck in this race conversation in that, well, you're black, you're white, you're mixed, you're Asian. It's like, well, that paradigm only exists here. And when we can start enriching ourselves and thinking about the other paradigms that exist, you know, so, you know, we've got really good friends in Malta, for example. We go over there, we have conversations. What are we? Are we British? Are we black? Are we, like, what are we in those conversations?
Yeah.
If we go to the States, I know Gary Young has written extensively about that, like, who is he when he goes over to the States versus who is he here? We don't, when we start doing that, we enrich the multifaceted nature of ourselves. And we're not just, I'm black girl from Birmingham. This is the box that I've been put in. I'm British. I'm of Jamaican heritage. I'm of Caribbean heritage. It enriches how we show up. And I think if more people can be doing that, but without the, and I'm thinking perhaps more about, you know, the white majority. If you can be going in the UK, if you can be going elsewhere and understanding and appreciating how different cultures operate and work and not seeing it through the lens of race, but realizing that there's some really good practices here. And it's nothing to do with race, but being able to bring that back without... It's really difficult for me to put it into words, but bringing that richness back and having some humility for the way that you show up within your white privilege or within your cave of privilege. You know, I've got some black privilege there as well. You know, within my education, we've all got our privileges. We can then be far more compassionate to the people that we see that are different from us. And I think for me, it will be compassion that will change the world. It would also mean that, you know, I think that, and this is coming from the States as well, I think very loudly, there's the competition of if I give up my seat for somebody else, I'm losing something to create diversity means I, as somebody who has had privilege, has to give up something. And you know, from what we've seen, that's not the way that things work. Yeah. There's enough stuff for everyone. The creative networks that are being created every single day are testament to that. The way that companies bring people in, or the partnerships that people, that companies make, is testament to that. You know,
it's not a zero sum game.
Exactly.
You know, which is kind of a hard thing for people to remember, but feel. Yeah. But it's true.
Yeah.
Well, look, thank you, Dr. Stacey Moore. I have the privilege of being able to talk to you a lot, which is great for me. Thank you for that. But it's been great to have you and hear your story. Great story, stuff that you never talked about. So thank you for giving us that opportunity, and really your perspectives, actually from a psychological perspective, on your life and race and how it shows up for all of us in our everyday life. So thank you for coming on. Thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you.
I'm sure you can come on again.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to come back. That's thanks right. A lot.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Cheers.